Because we don't see things how they really are, we suffer. So my metaphor for this as time has been that it's like we I don't know whether you've ever stayed the night in somebody else's house or gone to a hotel, and you wake up in the middle of the night and you think that you're in your own room. Let's imagine this for the moment. So you think you're in your own room and you go to the loo and you sort of walk into the wardrobe, or you can't find it, and you can't find the bed when you come back. You know, you keep on knocking into things. You've got this belief that you know where everything is, but you know it's just not like you're trying to find your clock, you can't find your clock. It's that kind of sense that our predicament is. It's not just that we don't know the nature of reality. That would be all right. Actually, that would be really, really good if we knew that we didn't know. Because if you don't know the nature of reality, you're very cautious about where you're going to go. You know, you'd be feeling around you. We actually thoroughly believe we do know the nature of reality. We know where the wardrobe is, where the desk is, where the bed is. And then we keep knocking into things, and we keep thinking, oh dear. And that throws us for a minute, but we think, no, I definitely know where I am. Yeah? So our problem is not just that we don't know the nature of reality, but that we insist on the fact that we do. And then that causes us to suffer. We keep on knocking into reality because we're so sure that it's like what we think it is. Yeah? And because of that, we suffer. So what I want to mainly... So that's really what we were talking about last week, very, very briefly. What I want to start talking about today is what are called the three levels of wisdom. So in a way, these three levels of wisdom, particularly the first two levels, are what we're going to be focusing on, what we are focusing on this course. So there's shutamaya prajna, which means listening, basically. A very simple translation is just to listen. And I'll say something about that in a minute. There's chintamaya prajna. Don't ask me for the spellings, ask Jana Vajra. I don't think I've been pronouncing it correctly. Which means reflecting. Yeah, reflecting. And there's bhavana maya prajna, which means, well, sometimes translated as meditation. It's really better to translate it as becoming. So when we do the metta bhavana, we're trying to bring into being metta. So bhavana maya prajna is bringing into being prajna, bringing into being wisdom. Yeah, ripening wisdom. I often mention that the word bhavana is usually the word that's translated into English as meditation. So when you see meditation written in English, it's usually the word bhavana that's used, which is making to become, or ripening, or becoming. So that tells you a lot about Buddhism straight away, that you're trying to bring something into being, you're trying to ripen something, you're trying to become something. Yeah. So the first thing to say about wisdom, and I'll get to explore each of these three wisdoms in the first half. First thing to say about it is it's not the same as knowledge. Yeah? It's not the same as merely knowing lots of things. Knowing lots of things can be really useful. It actually can be thoroughly not useful, depending on what you do with that knowledge. I've met people with fantastic knowledge that they don't seem to ever do anything with. Yeah? So it's not the same as knowing lots of things. It's not the same as being intellectually gifted. It's very obvious that the Buddha, it's thought the Buddha couldn't read or write. It's very unlikely the Buddha could have read or written. So you don't need to be able to write to understand, to get wisdom. You don't need to read. So it's nothing like knowledge. Yeah. And it's really important to get that clear, that when we're talking about wisdom, we're not talking about increasing intellectual sophistication. There's something to be said for increasing intellectual sophistication, especially if you're teaching, and some people will need it more than others. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and he was really sort of struggling with reading something. It was very obvious to me that he didn't need that level of intellectual sophistication. He found it actually unhelpful. He just found it confusing. Other people really do need quite a high level of intellectual sophistication and stimulus. But you don't need to have that. If you feel you don't need it, you don't have to have that. Yeah. But wisdom is not the same as intellectual sophistication. you need to have your emotions involved. You need to have the whole of yourself involved. The danger of intellectual sophistication of that kind of mindset, and it's so prevalent in the West. I mean, sometimes when we teach, John of Arc and I sometimes talk about, you get a sort of explanation phobia, where you just get tired of having to explain every little thing that you do. You know, you need a retreat, and now we're going to bow to the shrine. Bowing means, oh, no, it doesn't mean that, it doesn't mean that, don't worry about this. You know, you constantly kind of explaining things. And you want to just say, just do it, for heaven's sake. Why does everything have to be explained? The danger of intellectual sophistication, I think, is that you can just get better and better at it. You can be admired for it. And you can just get better at putting concepts together in a beautiful and rather pleasing way. And people will often admire you for that, or sometimes will admire you for that. And it can be mistaken for wisdom, that you're just very good or very quick with concepts. And if you're not careful, that becomes a positive block to wisdom. You just get better and better at using complex ideas. Yeah? I think it is a real danger. Not a real danger for me. Anyway, that's another matter. So your emotional state of mind, your whole being, is an essential part of wisdom. Wisdom has much to do with your body and your emotions, even your intuition, which I'll come to perhaps later, as it is to do with your thought. At the same time, I don't want to disparage thought. There's also another bit of a trend in the West of a kind of anti-thinking, that, you know, only silly posh people think, other people live, you know. And that's really just silly. Yeah. Most of us, I'm afraid, don't think very much. Most of us sort of ruminate, plan, go through pop songs in our heads, think about the Star Trek film. You know, that's not really quite what thinking is. Philosophers think. They try to think through into an issue and get deeper and deeper into it. Actually, we need to learn how to think and think clearly and deeply. Mostly what we do is sort of chatter rather than think. If you can think deeply and clearly, it's extremely beautiful. And I know people who can do that. Some of them speak with great simplicity, like Ratnagosha, some of you will know. I think of as a person with a great deal of wisdom. His thinking is very simple and very deep. His being is like that. And then we just had Subhuti staying with us. Subhuti is a bit like having Churchill to stay or Schopenhauer to stay. You know, he talks in different languages all the time and keeps throwing me. He keeps saying good morning in English, in French, and then in Hindi. And then, you know, we talk about economics, and I'm just completely out of my depth. He's this incredibly broad, highly intellectual, highly subtle thinker, but also a deep thinker. Yeah. But in a very, very different way to Ratnagosha. So it's worth just sort of holding up those two models. Neither are bad at all. Both of them are very impressive, I think very strongly imbued with a sense of wisdom. But they have quite different ways of expressing them. One of them is, you know, Subhuti is really quite philosophical in his outlook, and Ratnagosha is much more pragmatic, but no less deep. It's very striking when you hear Ratnagosha speak. So it's not the same as just being clever. Being clever is often one of the stupidest things we can be, I think. It's very charming just not to know things, but to be clever in the pejorative sense of being merely quick, usually to get around people or to think things up or even to react, it can be particularly foolish. And actually, Buddhism is mostly not difficult intellectually. It's not something that's particularly difficult to intellectually grasp. Some of the formulations can seem to be, and it does need you to make an effort in terms of thought, but it's not particularly difficult to grasp intellectually. The real difficulty is letting it into our mind. The real difficulty is really letting it change us. That's the great, in a way, difficulty of Buddhist spiritual practice, is letting wisdom affect us. We need to really let it affect our emotions, our life, how we treat one another, how we act in the world. That's the difficult thing. Understanding the basic concepts of Buddhism isn't that difficult, I don't think. So let me just go through these three: listening, reflecting, and meditating. I'm moving on already. So first of all, we do need to listen to the Dharma. Yeah? We need to listen to the teachings of Buddhism, Sutta-maya pranayama. And by listen, it also means read. It doesn't literally mean listen. It just means hear the teachings, read the teachings. Put ourselves in situations where the teachings can be taught to us. When you think of it, so many people are suffering because they haven't heard the teachings. I remember when I was young, I definitely wanted meaning in my life. I tried to find it in politics, I tried to find it in art, and I tried to find it when I was much younger in God. And I no longer believed in any of those things, really, as a solution. But I didn't have the Dharma for a long time. I didn't have the basic idea. I didn't realise even that there was a spiritual path that didn't involve God. I thought they inevitably involved God. So many, many people are in that situation. They are parched through lack of meaning and spiritual experience. But very many people don't realise that there is the Dharma there. There is a way of being genuinely and deeply spiritual. There is a way of leaving behind ordinary, mundane existence. There is a way of really transforming one's being without either believing in a deity that you can't believe in, or without destroying the spiritual life and just saying they're just mere matter. So many people, all they could do with is just hearing the Dharma. One of the things we need to do here at the centre is just get the Dharma out there much, much more, just as another alternative, another way of thinking. So we do need to be in a position where we can listen to the Dharma. And we really need to listen to the Dharma, which implies being really receptive to it, trying to understand what's being said, giving somebody the benefit of the doubt, seeing, what does this lead to? Not immediately finding problems with it, but just saying, well, let's see where this might take me, and really listen. I remember once I did a course on philosophy, another one of my overreaching myself, but we did this course on philosophy, and I was trying to explain the thinking of Kant, and I did a little set-up thing. I got a flower and said, okay, what can we see here? And I was trying to basically, very step-by-step, explain my understanding of what Kant was trying to say, what he was trying to think. And I was really struck by how quickly people made objections. Someone said, no, it's not like that. I said, I'd hardly started. I'd said his first half thought. And no, it's got a couple of that, it's not like that. Hang on. It's very, very strong, and this is purely metaphysical issues. It's to do with the nature of perception. I was trying to say, do you see how perception can't possibly be what we think it is? Yes, it can. No, wait a minute. I was really struck by how quickly people objected. Now, Kant may be wrong in some places, but it'd be worth, a lot of people have thought very highly of some of the things he said, so it'd be worth kind of seeing, I wonder what he means. But it was really striking how quickly people objected. And that can happen very easily, even in the act of listening. It's not the same as clarifying when you're saying, hang on, that doesn't make sense because you said that and that doesn't fit with that, so how can that be? That's really valuable, I think, and that comes on to the next stage in a minute. You need to sort of go with it for a bit and then find out what the questions are. Not too quickly object. The Buddha talks about different kinds of pots the Dharma goes into. And one of them is a cracked pot, where it just sort of flows into it. You hear the Dharma, but it makes no effect on you. You just let it, you hear, egolessness, shunyata, ethics, it all pours, you smile, lovely, isn't that lovely? It has no effect on you at all. It just flows straight out of the pot. You might be a pot that comes here very regularly, you might like this sense of water pouring through you, but it makes no difference, yeah? So that's one kind of pot. He also talked about a poison pot, where you're pouring the Dharma in, but actually there's already poison in the pot. There's negative attitude in the pot. And that's just changing the nature of what's going in. then there's the pot that's already full. So you've already full of your own ideas. This is what was happening in the philosophy course. People are already full of their own ideas, and we were trying to pour in a bit of Kant, and there just wasn't any room. It was just pouring over the top straight away. Yeah? There's that famous Zen story, isn't there, a Zen master pouring a disciple a cup of tea, and just pouring and pouring and pouring, and pouring over the cup, pouring over the table, pouring onto his knees. And said, "Why do you, you know, what are you doing?" He said, "Well, that's what you're like. It's not worth me teaching you, because you know your cup's already full. You're in a way too full of your own thoughts." Yeah? So listening is trying to avoid those kind of things. Actually, really hearing, yeah? Whether it's reading or whatever, really trying to hear the Dhamma. And then secondly, reflecting on the Dhamma. Cittimaya Pragna, reflecting on the Dhamma. The great challenge, as I said, is to bring the Dhamma into direct contact with your lived experience. Only then will it spark into insight. So I've just been writing a book on mindfulness, and I've been very struck how mindfulness of citta, which is your mental state, precedes mindfulness of dharmas, which is mindfulness of the teachings. And I think what it's saying is that you need to bring the teaching into mind in the moment you actually need it. So just when you're about to get into a bad mood, you, in that moment, bring to mind that hatred never overcomes hatred. In that moment, you try to bring the Dharma into your actual experience. So you're not having the Dharma with some sort of interesting ideas floating about, which you can have a learner discussion about. You're actually trying to touch your experience with the Dharma. So reflecting is like that. You're trying to really see how what you've heard affects your life, how it impacts on your life, how it agrees or disagrees with your behaviour, what it says about your life. You're trying to, in a way, make it wholly intimate to you, so that everything you do, there's something of the Dharma in there, there's a reflection in there. So a very simple, apparently simple, Buddhist idea, the central Buddhist idea is that all things are impermanent. And we can listen to that all the time, and it so often just goes in and out like nothing. But when a friend dies, when suddenly impermanence is thrust upon you, that reality just has a completely different meaning, doesn't it? It suddenly isn't just an interesting idea floating around, but it's an idea with teeth. It really affects you. And you can experience it in a wholly different way. It's a wholly different idea. It's not the same idea as it was when you thought about it as a simply a nice sort of Buddhist idea. It's got a wholly different feeling to it. I mentioned a little bit of this about last week. It's amazing the difference it is. It's the same kind of cognitive content, but your life can make that content completely different in its meaning. So this is what reflection is trying to do, is it's trying to bring what you've heard into a really completely direct experience of what's actually happening. You reflect, it goes into your life. Yeah? How do you apply it to yourself? How do you apply it to your life? What does it mean in terms of your work? What does it mean in terms of your relationships with others? What does it mean about walking down the street? When you're thinking all things are impermanent, how do we see that when we walk down the street? I remember doing this, thinking, so here I am, this is reality, it's all impermanent. Can I get any sense of that now? All these buildings around me? I sort of cognitively know they're impermanent, but they always seem to be there. You know, so you're trying to bring it into direct experience like that. Also, I think this is trying to see about your own views. Trying to see what you think and believe. And just see what they're like, whether those views and beliefs are like when you put them next to the Dharma. It's also exploring your own views, and our views are very, very deep. We often don't realise that we've got our views. So we might have nihilistic views, for instance, that when you die, they're just nothing. You're just obliterated, you're just destroyed at the moment of death, and there's nothing left over. That's a view you have. You don't actually know that. What you have is lack of evidence. You don't know that's the truth, but you think you know it is. It's that idea we have, as I said at the start, you think that you're in your bedroom and you're actually in a hotel room. And however often you knock into things, you keep insisting that that is actually true. Whereas it is, from a Buddhist point of view, just a view you have. It's a belief you had. And if you lived 500 years ago, you'd have a different belief. You'd think that you die and you go to heaven, probably, if you came to, or hell or something, if you lived in Europe at least. So, you're even the ideas that you think are just true and that you've known them since you were a child, they're just ideas you have, they're views you have. There's no place where you haven't got views. The only person who hasn't got views is a Buddha. One of the attributes of the Buddha is that they have no view. They have no attitude to things. They're not pre-cooked. They don't have a preconceived idea about anything. Now, we'd like to think that we're like that, but we're not. I always think genes are the obvious example. We all, you know, they're sold on being a kind of, you know, do as yourself, individual on a horse, possibly. But everybody buys them, you know, everybody buys them. We do usually what a particular society and a particular historical epoch tells us to do. And nihilism is very much the fashion of the moment, really. And 200 years ago, it was a different fashion. But we really believe those things. So reflection is also trying to reflect on the views that we have in relationship to the Dhamma. And then thirdly, meditation or bhavana is making to become. So becoming wisdom. Particularly in meditation, realizing wisdom directly. Realizing it directly in your experience. And this is so different from mere cognitive knowledge that you may as well call it something else. That's why it's valuable to have this word wisdom, I think. Because it's nothing like a mere knowing of something. Like you know where Poland is, or you know about art history, or you know anything else. It's quite different. I remember in a meditation, for instance, a while ago, I was distracted by something. And I caught myself being distracted. And for some reason, I just thought, gosh, I don't really know what's going to happen next, do I? Not really. And for some reason, that thought was like this sort of wormhole, went right down into some very deep truth that, no, I absolutely didn't. I think I do. I always think I do. What's happening next? Well, I'll carry on talking. We'll have tea. Oh, then I've got some emails to do, and I go to bed, and then tomorrow's going to be a busy day. You know, I think I do, but I don't know at all. And in this meditation, just for a moment, I realised that I had no idea what's going to happen next. They were just ideas. They're just kind of a whole net of views and ideas. But I actually didn't know. And it was a literal moment of illumination. It suddenly felt like I was closer to some massive reality. And then I thought, oh, that's interesting. And it disappeared. You know, seriously, ooh. Now I'm a spiritual person. Suddenly it all disappears. But that experience is so different from merely knowing that you don't know. That's hardly got any real content at all. It's just a kind of idea, just like lots of ideas that we have. Yeah. So what we're going to be doing on this course, what we are exploring on this course, mainly is the first two kinds of wisdom. We're exploring listening, really listening, trying to listen with a nice pot that the water can just come in and stay in. We're trying to reflect on what we hear. How does it directly affect me in my life? Try to turn it over in our mind, try to bring it into our life more and more. And that becomes a basis for insight. So what we're trying to do, from a Buddhist point of view, is have a thoroughly what we would call dharmic perspective on life. And we're trying to have that perspective all the time, so that when things happen to us, it becomes an opportunity for insight. Yeah? So when a sexual relationship breaks down, friend dies, when something happens, you've been reflecting about the nature of existence, you've been thinking about it, you've been listening about it, and when it comes closer to you like that, and it will do, in some form or another, all the time, even if it's just something you liked ending, when it comes closer like that, you'll be ready to see it in a useful, spiritually valuable way. Instead of just falling into depression or despair or into problematizing it, you'll think, oh, I've been thinking about this, haven't I? I've been reflecting on this. And this dharmic perspective is really difficult to get. One of the things I noticed reading Bhante Sangharakshita is, particularly his memoirs, is how much he sees everything from a Buddhist point of view, and how deep that is with him. Anything that, from ordering a pizza to looking at a painting to anything he does, to walking down the street, it's all very deeply seen from this Buddhist point of view. One of his books of letters is called Through Buddhist Eyes. And very few of us can have Buddhist eyes quite like that. It's much, much more difficult than we think. Our eyes are affected by what our mother told us before we were seven, our cultural conditioning, our gender, all kinds of things, our political affiliations, our group affiliations. And we see things through all those kind of eyes. What Buddhism is saying is you need to see with Buddhist eyes, with the eyes of the Dharma. And then those eyes will really help you see the nature of things. So that Buddhist vision constantly needs to be refreshed, constantly needs to be rediscovered. It's not just a set of ideas that you have, Buddhist ones, nice Buddhist ones. You constantly have to rediscover the Buddhist vision. One of the reasons why I teach is because it helps me constantly rediscover the Buddhist vision. But one of the reasons why I live with my friends in the community upstairs is because I'm reminded again and again of the Buddhist vision. Why I write books, one of the reasons I really enjoy writing this book is because it keeps reminding me of the Buddhist vision. And I can't be reminded often enough. And every time I'm a bit closer to that Buddhist vision, I feel happier, life makes sense more, everything fits into some overarching spiritual sense, which so easily I fall away from. I fall back into my own personal and psychological history, I fall back into my own childhood traumas, I fall back into habitual ways of relating to people, habitual pessimisms or whatever they are. When I can get close to that Buddhist vision, I feel much more secure from all that, much more protected from my own, from my other histories, if you see what I mean. We've all got these histories, from my other histories. So that's what I mainly wanted to say, first of all, is that we've got these three levels of wisdom: listening to the Dharma, reflecting on the Dharma, trying to become the Dharma, trying to actually become eventually the Buddha. And what we're going to be doing mainly, what we are doing mainly on this course, is doing the first two.